My name is Mark Edwards, and this is one of a series of sessions on Martin Luther. And specifically, we're dealing with Martin Luther and war, or the just war. We've chosen that topic for today, of course, because today we're commemorating Hiroshima. And so it might be useful, or at least stimulate some thinking, to look at our Christian tradition and the ways in which some of the major Christian figures leading up to and including Martin Luther have thought about war and Christian participation in war. Now, I'd encourage you, please, to stop me at any point, ask questions. I will try to leave a lot of time at the end to talk about some of the issues that I raise. I also frequently wander around the patio up there, coffee cup in hand, and would appreciate if you have questions or you want to talk about something, stop me there or sit down with me at lunch or dinner or whatever. I'm going to be here through Saturday. I take off along with 128 or 129 other people on Saturday. Let's begin with something that we many people may not realize, and that is Christians have always taken the position that war is evil. There's really no doubt about its being evil. The issue really has always been whether it's a necessary evil or it's an evil that one can engage in because it forestalls a greater evil. The early Christians tended, there are exceptions, but for the first few centuries, the early Christians tended to take the position that Jesus has commanded to resist not evil, to turn the other cheek, bless those who persecute you, and so on. And so the early Christians, by and large, were pacifists. That is, they refused to participate in war. This refusal was in part because of the notion they should not resist evil or they should bless those that persecute them. They also refused to participate in the army, the imperial army, because the imperial army normally offered sacrifice to the gods and to the emperor and would march into war with standards that indicated their allegiance to the Roman gods. And so not only was there an objection to violence and resisting evil, there was an objection to idolatry. This all changes in the 4th century. The ruler of the West, a man named Constantine, has a signal victory in 313. Right before the victory, he had seen the sign of the cross in the skies, or he heard a dream. There were different stories which said that gave him the Cairo, the first two letters of the word Christ, and said, in this sign you will conquer. In any case, he was successful and was felt that Christianity had been responsible for his success. And so he made Christianity a legal religion. He gave it various political and economic privileges in the empire. And less than 100 years later, it is the sole legal form of religion within the empire. So Christians were then forced to rethink their attitudes toward war. Rethink because they had moved from being a minority sect within a larger empire to being the official religion of the empire. And since the empire was Christian and the surrounding neighbors were pagan, it was strong impetus for Christians to justify the defense of the empire as a defense of Christianity. To handle this, they did several things. One, they took the commandments, such as resist not evil and turn the other cheek, which had up to this point largely applied to all Christians, and they instead said that these were not commandments so much as counsels, the counsels of Jesus. They were the counsels that if you followed them, you were leading the most perfect life. Most Christians, they said, really only had to obey the Ten Commandments. And the thou shalt not kill referred to murder, not to being a soldier. And those people who wanted to pursue a more perfect life, these were called the religious, monks, nuns, and priests, they were expected to follow not merely the commandments, but also the counsels of Jesus or the counsels of Christ. And so pacifism became, at least in theory, the ideal of the clergy or the religious. whereas most lay people could participate in war if it met certain criteria. There's the rub, certain criteria. Christians realized since war was an evil that they had to be careful about whether what wars Christians could participate in. And by the way, even when they did participate in a war which met all the criteria, normally a soldier who shed blood in the course of carrying out the war was expected to undergo very severe penance before full readmission into the Christian community. What were the criteria? Here they borrowed from classical authors, especially Cicero, and develop what was called the theory of the just war applied to a Christian context. The person who, for the West, more or less established the understanding of the just war is Augustine. Like many other things, Augustine is the theologian which sort of sets the boundaries of theological discussion into the 20th century. I have said before, those of you who've been in other sessions, that if you could write philosophy the history of philosophy as a footnote to Plato, you could write the history of Western theology as a footnote to Augustine. Augustine was important, one, for laying out the just war and some of the criteria for the just war, and I will not elaborate them now because I'll come back to them when I talk about Luther. He was also, however, important for developing the crusade, or at least the rationalization for the crusade ideology. Let me explain how that happens. First, this is from the Resource Center. Don Erlander, who has taught here many times in the past, prepared a little sheet. And although it doesn't fit exactly with what I'm doing here today, I thought I would pass it around. You're welcome to take one if you're interested. It defines some of the major terms and gives brief descriptions. And by the way, if you have time and you want to listen to tapes, almost any of Dan Erlander's tapes is worth picking out and listening to. He has one on Revelation in which the lamb he calls Fluffy. And you really have to hear his tapes to understand how the description of the lamb as Fluffy really works. All right. The Crusade. Augustine was a bishop living in northern Africa. He was the bishop in a little town called Hippo. And the surrounding area was controlled by a group of Christians that had broken off from the main body of Christianity some 100 years earlier. These individuals were called Donatists, after one of their early bishops. They believed that in the persecutions that had preceded Constantine's coming to the imperial throne, that various Christians had fallen away. They had handed over the scriptures or had buckled under during the persecution. And in falling away or buckling under, they had lost their sanctity. They had lost the ability to effectively perform the sacraments, especially the sacrament of baptism and Eucharist. And ordination, that is, passing on the authority from one bishop to another. And as a result, they believed that not only had they fallen away, but all the people that they had then ordained had not really been truly ordained. So you had two groups arguing about the sacraments. I've already given you more information about Donatists than you really need. The important thing is that there was almost a warfare going on between what we'll call the Catholic Christians and the Donatists in North Africa. The Donatists would stage raids on the Christians, and the Christians would respond. And finally, the emperor sent troops into North Africa to forcibly bring the Donatists back into the Catholic Church. Now, up to this point, being a bishop of the minority group, Augustine had been waging a war of kisses, essentially writing and saying we should not use force to coerce belief, we should just talk this out, love, and so on. Now suddenly the emperor has intervened, and he is literally driving these Donatists, giving the Donatists the choice between rejoining the larger Catholic Church or being killed. And Augustine is forced to confront this and decide whether he thinks it's appropriate or not. And after some consideration, he does. He does think it's appropriate, and he offers the following rationalization. Augustine was a strong believer in providence, the way in which God uses the world to bring about God's own ends. God uses the world, for example, to bring those people, God, who has predestined to salvation, to their ultimate salvation. And God could even use the evil of others. For example, the envious scolding of an individual, which suddenly makes one's conscience flare up, and although that other person was not trying to help you, it's just, you know, dumping on you, God uses that evil act, though, to bring you to God's ultimate, you know, wherever God has determined you should eventually go. So that even evil can be used by God to bring about good and to bring about salvation of individuals. And Augustine decided that the use of force in bringing the Donatists back into the church was a case of where God was using evil to bring about good. This was an example of God's providence. In this regard, it helped that Augustine had a very strong notion of the power of the sacraments, especially the sacrament of baptism. So that, to illustrate this, he told a story of a friend of his back in his Manichaean days. There was a time where Augustine was not a Christian. He was a Manichaean, one of a group of people who believed the world was divided up into two camps, with a good and evil, and there was a war going on between these two equal camps. And a friend of his, who also was a Manichaean, became gravely ill, and while in a coma, was baptized a Christian. Then he came to himself again, and Augustine, according to his own accounts, began teasing him, they baptized you a Christian while you were sick. And instead of his friend responding as he expected, his friend rebuked him, indicated that he now was sincerely believed in Christianity, and that he wanted to have nothing more to do with Augustine or with Manichaeanism. And the friend then, shortly thereafter, had a relapse and died as a good Christian, was Augustine's belief. Now, what had happened? The fellow was unconscious when it happened, and yet afterwards he was a true believer. Augustine reached the conclusion that it was the power of the sacraments. And this was particularly important in the Donatist controversy as well, because the worthiness of the individual, either the recipient or the person performing the sacrament, was not at issue. At issue was that it was God's sacrament, and that God could bring this about even with someone who was unconscious. So if you force the Donatists in, or you force people to convert to Christianity, the sacrament under which they, the sacrament itself may turn a coerced belief into a true belief. Follow me? Does it make you feel very comfortable? That's the ideology. This notion of both just war and crusade moved into the medieval period. You know, the Middle Ages is a fusion or a combination of classical civilization with German civilization, producing something new, European civilization. And in the process, the niceties of just war were lost, and crusades were often fought. Crusades where Christians went out to kill Christ's enemies. One of the clearest examples of the logic behind the crusade was the crusaders in the 11th century who went to liberate the Holy Land from the infidel, which were Turks, Islamic, they were Muslims, but they're Turkish tribes that had captured the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean. And since they were going to go out excuse me, and kill for Christ in the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean, they decided that they might as well kill for Christ on the way, and so they butchered tens of thousands of Jews in the Rhineland area who happened to have the misfortune of being along the path of march of the crusading armies. Actually, what they did is they gave them a choice between converting to Christianity or dying, and most of the Jews chose to die. This is the background, sort of the attitudes towards war when we come to Martin Luther. Luther was living in a time where the world was very unstable. There was concern about anarchy. There was a threat, an external threat, the Turks, sort of the other superpower of the day, were Muslims, and they were pushing against the eastern flank of Europe. In fact, the Turkish armies surrounded, besieged the city of Vienna in 1529, and then again a few years later. They were not only very aggressive, but they were a different ideology, a different religion. It's sort of like the Western democracies and communism today. Luther himself and Lutherans were threatened not only by the Turks, but also threatened by Catholic princes and Catholic cities who repeatedly called for a crusade to wipe out the Protestants. And in fact, there was a war in the year of Luther's death in 1546. The Catholic forces attacked the Protestants and defeated them. And had not a Protestant prince who originally fought for the Catholics and then turned coat and fought for the Protestants, Protestantism might well have been wiped out in the middle of the 16th century. So there was the fear, threat of Catholic attack. There were also internecine quarrels. Luther's Holy Roman Empire was, as Voltaire said some centuries later, neither Holy Roman nor an empire. It wasn't an empire because it was really a conglomeration of little princedoms and city-states and knight, independent imperial knights and so on. There were somewhere between 200 and 300 autonomous groups, and they often were fighting with each other, and that would mean even Protestants fighting Protestants and Catholics fighting Catholics. Moreover, for various economic reasons, there was considerable unrest among the peasantry. The 15th and early 16th century had seen a period of real inflation. At the same time, there inflation in manufactured and finished goods, and at the same time that the price of cereals and the like had declined. And so the nobility that lived off of their landed estates were caught in a crunch. They wanted to buy the luxury goods, but the income from their lands was insufficient. And they responded by reimposing on the peasantry many manorial obligations, taxes and services and the like, that had largely been allowed to lapse in the previous couple of centuries. And so although they were, at least theoretically, entitled to many of these dues, they hadn't collected them in memory. So the peasantry was very upset. And in fact, in the middle of Luther's lifetime, you probably all heard, in 1524, 1525, there was a great peasants' uprising large sections of southern and central Germany rose up. And the Reformation played an important part in this uprising, because in the past they'd always been local uprisings. The Reformation gave the ideology that turned local discontent into a wide-scale uprising. And of Luther, of course, you may also know, after initially saying, pox on both of your houses, both the princes and the peasants, once the uprising was well underway, he issued a vicious attack on the peasants and told the princes, even though he thought the princes were wicked and evil, they were better, he felt, than the revolting peasants. He told the princes that they should stab, kill, and slay as many as they could find, because there was nothing worse than rebels. And that there wasn't a devil in hell, he said. They had all gone out into the peasants. So this is the type of situation in which he was living, very different from our own. He was forced, therefore, to take into account both his own understanding of the Christian tradition about war and make it work in his own contemporary situation. He also had the problem of, on the one hand, justifying his own refusal to obey secular authority. After all, he had defied the emperor. He was an outlaw. He wrote real stinging attacks on Catholic princes. He had to be able to justify his own rebellion, his own religious revolution, while at the same time convincing those princes who decided to support him that he was not a threat to the stability of society. You can see the problem that he had. He did this first by coming up with what we know as today as the two kingdoms theory. He argued essentially that there were two forms of authority in the world, both of them ordained by God. They were one was not divine and the other, as it were, secular. Rather, God had created two ways in which God ruled the world. On the one hand, God ruled the world through the temporal sword, and that was to restrain evil. That was the secular power. That was there he could turn to Romans chapter 13 or Peter's comments, and I guess it's 1st or is it 2nd Peter. On the other hand, God had chosen to rule the world also through the spiritual government, which was the church. And Luther distinguished between two types of government, both from God, the spiritual and the temporal, and then two types of coercion, ways of getting things done. The form of coercion in the secular realm was the sword. It was what we think of as force, violence. But in the spiritual realm, Luther contended, the only form of coercion was the word of God. You would preach the word of God. But that's the only type of coercion that should be applied. When he looked around himself, Luther was convinced that one of the ways in which Satan was particularly active in his society was by confusing these two forms of government. He looked at the papacy, which after all was not claimed to be both the religious authority but also a secular authority. And he saw that mixing of the two, where the church was said to also bear the sword, was the sign of the devil at work. It was the devil's handiwork. Actually said many more nasty things than that about that sort of arrangement. He also saw cases where the secular authority interfered in the religious realm. For example, Catholic princes who forbade their subjects from buying and reading Luther's translation of the New Testament. That was the case of the secular authority interfering and using the power of the sword in the spiritual realm. And he condemned both. Both are God's creations. Both have their own proper form of coercion. But the two should not be confused. And I'll come back to that in a moment. His attitude towards war, the just war, fits into this larger theory or this larger understanding. And of course, Luther had many proof texts from Scripture to undergird his understanding of the two kingdoms or the two governments. There were three types of war, Luther said. There were a war between equals, war between superiors waged against subordinates, and war where subordinates are fighting against superiors. The last we call rebellion or revolution. And we, time permitting, although the way I'm going, I'm not sure, we'll talk about that as well. What I'm going to focus in on the war between equals, and here is where the classical just war theory is applied, with a few twists that Luther adds that are unique to him. One, Luther insisted that the war had to be defensive. Here he greatly restricted the classical definition where the war had to be just. Luther said that even if it was just, if in the sense that someone had wronged you, unless that person had actually attacked you, the war would be inappropriate, unchristian. It had to be defensive. It had to be in self-defense. So that was one. Luther condemned a preventative attack. Or you know someone's going to attack you, so you attack them first. He said that was totally immoral, and he and Melanchthon threatened to leave, to go off and be wanderers, he said, on the highways of the empire, if his prince continued in his design to wage to have a preventative attack on one of the Catholics. So Luther was not docile. He told his princes when he thought the princes were wrong. In this case, he and Melanchthon threatened to actually leave Secondly, the war had to have a just cause. And here the justice of the cause had to be determined not by some magical rules, but by reason. You know, it had to determine that there was a wrong done to you, and that you were not, that your justice was on your side rather than the other side. It also had to be waged by proper authorities. That goes back to his notion of the two forms of government, and one of the secular government, which is the only government, he said, that should wage war, because it bears the sword, it should be done under the auspices of this government. Private individuals should not take it up. The third point is the goal should be peace and obedience. That is, you fight war, it's an evil, a necessary evil, and you fight it in order to return to the state of peace. And obedience is part of that peace, obedience to authority. The fourth thing that he said, and here again, he and Augustine in the past have a much more sophisticated notion of war than many of the intervening figures. Because Luther, looking at the history of the wars in the Hebrew scriptures, saw that often Israel, although it was just and had God on its side, lost its wars. Why did it lose its wars? Because God sometimes used war to punish the people Israel, the nation Israel. Just because you have justice on your side, just because you're good Christians, you might still lose. And God would be justified in allowing you to lose, because even though you're Christians, you're still sinful. So that war should always be fought in fear of God, with the realization that God might decide to let you lose, even though you've met all the points. And the last thing that Luther insisted upon was that the means had to be commensurate with the ends. Or to put it another way, war is fought because some evil has been done, or is ongoing. The war itself is an evil. And if you put the war in the balance scale and the evil which it's is supposed to prevent, they should balance out in such a way that the evil of the war itself does not outweigh the evil it's meant to prevent. As Luther put it, you have to be careful that in picking up the spoon you don't step on the dish. It's a German proverb. That in trying to do something or rectify a small evil, you create a much greater evil. And if the means were not commensurate with the ends, the war should not be fought, even though all of these other criteria. By the way, this is an intriguing notion when you look at modern warfare. Certainly with nuclear weapons, I think at least is a fairly compelling case, but I want us to all talk about it. It could be made that the use of nuclear arms always violates this criteria.
Go back to the defensive. Would Luther say that once you've attacked, or if a nation has attacked your nation or kingdom, whatever, that all you can do is to push them back to their line, and that's all? You cannot invade then another kingdom, or
right.
You just to the borders and then you stop.
Right.
The borders are assumed to be good borders.
Yes.
Given if you were citizens in Germany in mid and late 30s, how would you have the information to evaluate a just and unjust war?
Good.
The Nazis having the total control of information.
I'm glad you asked that question. That brings me to point four.
You can pay me later.
Right. Yeah, we have a set this up in the audience. Luther insisted that Christians, God rules the realm in two ways. A Christian lives in both realms and is subject to both governments. When there's a conflict, however, between the two, where one's understanding of the word and one's obligations as a Christian come in conflict with what the secular authorities are asking you to do, that is, when the secular authority asks you to participate in an unjust war, you are obliged to refuse and suffer the consequences. Luther was an advocate of what we call passive resistance. He said that if your government wanted you to do something which you in good conscience could not do, which you as a Christian failed to meet these criteria, you had the absolute obligation as a Christian not to participate. And I can read some quotes in which he talks about, the knight. Warriors in his day were normally paid for their involvement in the military by large grants of land. So a nobleman, in exchange for the land and income from land, was expected to serve in the in his lord's armed forces and perhaps bring other soldiers with him. And it was a contract where if he did not perform the military service, he lost all of his land and all of his income, his property, and his position and his title and so on. And so it was Luther was saying, that's too bad, but as true Christians, you're asked perhaps even to forsake your mother and father. You may be asked to give up all of your property if your prince asks you to participate in a war which you think is unjust. But how can you know whether it's just or unjust? In a sense, you need a lot of information to go through. The fact that it's difficult to get this information does not excuse a Christian from trying to figure this out. The Christian has the obligation to try to, as best he or she can, to determine whether the war they're asked to participate in is just. But Luther said, if you're not sure, you may in good conscience participate, because the authorities are ordained by God, and although they may be waging an unjust war, if you can't tell whether they are or not, you should participate. You are then fulfilling God's command, and God will punish the rulers later on for their mistake. So if you're uncertain, and here, of course, this is a matter of prudence. If you have a strong inclination towards thinking that it isn't just, but you're not absolutely positive, you probably shouldn't participate. But if you're really sort of confused, then you should go ahead in good conscience and participate. That was his advice. They undertook to fight against the Turk in the name of Christ, he writes, and taught and incited people to do this, as though our people were an army of Christians against the Turks, who were enemies of Christ. This is absolutely contrary to Christ's doctrine and name. It is against Christ's doctrine because he says that Christians shall not resist evil, fight, or quarrel, nor take revenge or insist on rights. It is against his name because there are scarcely 5 Christians in such an army, and perhaps there are worse people in the eyes of God in that army than are the Turks. And yet they all want to bear the name of Christ. This is the greatest of all sins and is one that no Turk commits, for Christ's name is used for sin and shame and thus dishonored. All right, let me raise for your consideration. We're going to do the anachronistic leap. We're going to go from the 16th century with a very different society and different conditions, and we're going to leap into the 20th and ask ourselves, first, what about this? Is this any use in thinking about war today? This is very much in our Lutheran heritage. And in fact, we talk about just war in the confessions. But also, I would like, what about crusades? Because today, especially recently, we've heard a lot about the evil empire and godless, atheistic communism. And our defense is often framed in crusading terms, where essentially all of these things are out the window because our cause is the cause of God. And as the cause of God, it outweighs any other consideration. Or a variation on the godless atheistic communism is the ideological crusade, which says, we are fighting for freedom and democracy. Better red than dead. And so in the name of freedom and democracy, we can fight almost any war without concern for this. Luther, I think, would condemn both of those arguments. But what do we think today? Thoughts, reactions, questions? Yes?
Now, that World War II could be considered a just war.
World War II is a just war. What do people think of that?
I remember reading an argument by a Catholic theologian on that very issue. It was very scholastic in the whole, the arguments are very detailed. But in particular, it was dealing with the question of whether In Germany, we had to invade Germany itself because it had shown itself with the particular totalitarian regime that we needed to wipe that out or completely replace it. But he was arguing that it was not necessary to do that with Japan, that Japan had been working on a different basis and therefore only needed to go back to the previous borders. We did not need to invade it or to particularly the use of nuclear weapons in that place at that time.
So the criticism there is that although the war might have been just initially, we pursued it beyond the point where it was just.
The only question I have like that, is that, of course, we developed boundaries, for instance, the Philippines, because of a war we had with the Spanish Americans. And therefore, we think we have to go back and retake the Philippines. The argument that are they really ours to begin with? And in our whole manifest destiny of taking us all the way across the Pacific, and I mean, there's so many other parts and levels to it that you can't just say, because it's just where we should, therefore, it's going to take Philippines or whatever else.
Well, manifest destiny seems to me to fall under the crusading ideology. You're all familiar with manifest destiny, the notion that the United States was destined by God to conquer the whole continent, and I don't know, not even stop at the Pacific, keep going. Yeah.
I haven't thought this thing through, but it might be an interesting thought to some people, that because today we're celebrating Hiroshima, and my dates may not be completely accurate, but I think I'm close to it. Around 1939, maybe 1938, there was a meeting, a worldwide meeting of physicists. And at that time, two German physicists, whose name I can't remember, maybe somebody else would know, reported an experiment in which the, I can't remember the definition, but fission was demonstrated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Albert Einstein was at that meeting. And when he returned, he wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying that in his view, that reaction or whatever was capable of producing a weapon. And in his view, I don't remember the letter, I never saw the letter, my recollection is that whichever nation were to reach that stage first could prove a threat to other nations, in his view. And that was the beginning of the Manhattan Project. The only thing I'm saying, not trying to justify anything, but if the war were not to have been pursued, there's no doubt in my mind, based on what the Germans did with rockets and so on, that they would have developed the atomic bomb. And I'll leave it to your own imagination whether or not they would use it. But that information, which was presented in 1939, certainly from the scientific community, was a clear-cut new weapon. I'm sorry to say that most weapons or advances are used as weapons, first of all.
Yeah, maybe to put the use of the atomic bomb into some perspective, in the late Middle Ages, before Luther even was born, they developed the cannon and also the ancestor to the rifle. And for a time, people were convinced that they were weapons that completely violated the means commensurate with the end, because you could kill at a distance and blow a whole bunch of people up. And of course, the nobles who wore all this armor and what have you and were used to riding around on their horses and directing the foot soldiers, suddenly a person who couldn't read or write and had not a single drop of noble blood could sit down safely behind a hill and kill the nobleman. And so the nobles, whenever they caught anyone with one of these weapons, would execute them immediately for violating the principles of civilized warfare. Civilized warfare was they got to command and other people got to die. But it was felt with a cannon that it was no longer possible for there to be a just war, because part of the, elaborating on this thing slightly, non-combatants were not supposed to be involved. Of course, they always were in wars, but they're supposed to be minimized. With a cannon, you could stand back, and bombard a city and destroy people right and left. What do you think? What do atomic weapons do to this notion? Or what about our strategy of, what is it called, mutually assured destruction?
Just on one level, It goes back to, you pointed out that Luther was directly opposed to the strike before you get hit first. With your point, what I can see is that By us developing it first, yes, we can say that we probably saved ourselves this, but, or, you know, we saved ourselves from being destroyed by the enemy, but isn't that striking first in anticipation of being struck by them? On the developmental level, it's not the actual killing, I suppose, but it's...
At Hiroshima, we did use the atomic bomb in Japan. I mean, Germany had already surrendered, and there was no indication that Japan had the atomic weapon. But, you know, in a way, we can't refight World War II. Let's ask ourselves right now. Let's say the Soviet Union attacks us with atomic weapons. Are we justified? Are we Lutherans able to support the notion that we would then fire off our weapons in reply?
Well, to pick a few nits here, there's all sorts of ranges of nuclear weapons, and I'm sure the military would come back and say, well, this is just a small one to hit the supply depot, and this is a small one to hit the tanks, and this is this and that. And so then you, oh, we hit a few civilians, but that's all right. And so the question for them may or may not be nuclear weapons, but does it achieve the military aims?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where they're targeting missile silos or strategic.
And then sooner or later you get into the bigger question, whoops, there was a city in the way.
Yeah.
But it would almost make, I mean, you use Luther's argument to really defend Star Wars or Strategic Defense Initiative, that it really is a defensive, you know, development of a defensive shield against nuclear weapons to protect us, and that that would make a lot of sense from a Lutheran perspective.
That's if we believe Star Wars would be 100% successful.
Well, not even 100% successful. Even if it was 80%, it would at least give the Soviet Union or any other nation the idea that, well, going to war would be very costly because we probably wouldn't be able to do to effectively use it. Now, I mean, you'd argue that.
The intent of Star Wars, in my mind, because they know it can't be 100% successful, is that it's used in a twofold fashion, with a first strike and then a mopping up operation. And people are agreeing that the scientists and all of the military people know that Star Wars cannot succeed. It's never going to be tested, therefore it's never going to work, because the computer software is never going to be successful on a first-time basis, ever. So they know it can't be successful, so it has to be coordinated with a first strike and then a mop up of any weapons that come back at us.
So it's not a defensive weapon at all?
It's not a defensive item at all.
So what about the question as to whether Luther was right? I mean, is that a bunch of garbage, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate question. And Luther himself said, I was not crucified for anyone. The doctrine is not mine. You know, how can it happen that I, as he put it, a poor, stinking maggot food, should have the... children of Christ called by my name. We don't have to follow Luther. We are expected to follow Christ. The question is only whether Luther and the whole tradition out of which he's drawn, I mean, he's modifying in some ways, but there's a whole tradition behind him. Does that tradition help us think about our admittedly very different situation in the 20th century? I mean, I think Luther would have had enough trouble with an airplane, much less an atomic bomb. You know.
Mark?
Yes.
I have a related question, I guess. I guess the way I would answer it is that I don't believe that there is a just war in a nuclear age. But the question I have, and I'm just curious whether Luther addressed this, again, we can't expect Luther to address everything, is what about the payment of taxes for an unjust war? You mentioned that in the case of an unjust war or an unjust governmental policy, that we have the obligation, Luther said, to resist that and face the consequences. Did he ever address in any direct or indirect way what that meant in terms of paying for injustice?
Yes, taxes that were being collected for crusades against the Turks, as opposed to taxes. He supported the notion of the tax to pay for an army that was going to stop the Turks. He opposed, violently opposed, paying taxes to the church that was going, which in turn was supposed to use the money for crusades. So
So the same judgment would have to be made by us, essentially, of whether war preparation was for a just cause or a defensive purpose versus other things.
Yeah, I mean, Luther would take that position. Now, it's very nice to set it out simply in those terms. It's a much harder situation to sort of parse it all and figure out Yes, he refused and urged his followers not to pay certain taxes to the church. On the other hand, he paid well more than he was supposed to, according to his property, in order to fund the war against the Turks. He just insisted it was not a Christian crusade, it was a defensive war. In this case, he was right. The Turks were attacking. The Christians weren't out attacking the Turks. It was the other way around.
Mark, what would Luther have said about war by proxy, such as we're looking at the Nicaraguan situation?
Well, once again, it's very hard with the 400 years. He writes a treatise, whether soldiers too may be saved, which is addressed to a knight who had qualms about participating in the military. And essentially, Luther said that if these other criteria were met, and he was fighting for the proper authorities and so on, that the person, it was a legitimate war, but it had to be defensive. A proxy war, Luther would have real trouble with any war fought that wasn't dealing with the defense of one's own boundaries. So wars of national interest, for example, getting involved in a war in the Middle East because it's... You see, that's, in part, Luther has no sense of economics. So a good argument could be made that, although it's not attacking our borders in the sense that they're lobbing missiles in, that cutting off our oil supply is just as much an attack on our well-being. The argument could be made, and then it would be up to the individual to weigh the pros and cons. Luther said there was no magic way of finding out the answer. Every Christian had to, in prayer and with the use of his or her God-given reason, figure out what the appropriate response was. And Christians could legitimately disagree with each other and would disagree, because this is the realm of reason and prudence.
So the church wouldn't necessarily come out and say if this was a war was just or unjust.
Well, even if the church did, the individual Christian was not absolved of responsibility. Yeah. The church had a responsibility. The church and Luther himself often did get out and issue public statements telling his prince that he was behaving badly, or that others were. And he felt the church had that responsibility. The church was not supposed to sit there and just let the government run everything, because God ruled in both realms, and the church had the power of the word. But the church wasn't. The church's response was by preaching the word, which could be a very prophetic, critical word. But it couldn't coerce people, for example, not to pay taxes or to resist. The individual, as Luther said, just as someone else cannot die for me, someone else cannot believe for me. And similarly, you can't coerce belief. Belief is either there or it isn't there, and that's a response to the preached word. I personally... I'm a pacifist, and I worked through during the Vietnam War. I worked as with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, helping people out of the military. I was a military counselor, people who were COs in the military, trying to help them out. And I personally don't see how modern warfare, not just atomic bombs, but napalm and high altitude bombing, and how the means thing can ever be met again. But I also can see many people who I consider, as far as I can tell, to be good Christians who disagree with me about that. But let's turn to the other one, which I think may be even more appropriate for the American context, and that is the insistence that the crusade is always wrong. Do you think I'm being far-fetched and suggesting that we may be working with a crusading ideology in this country?
It's with the rise in the... fundamentalism in the government, in fact, that it's a way that people that the government can arouse the people to fight the wars, to support the war that we're waging against Nicaragua, saying that this is in the name of God, therefore we can look beyond the killing. So it's a propaganda tool that's being used right now. So I agree with you when you say, persons like President Reagan and Colonel North are making it out to be a crusade against the evil empire.
What about the war for freedom and democracy? Let's say it's true that everything that the Reagan administration says about Nicaragua is true. I happen to think it's not the case, but we could differ on that. But let's assume they really are persecuting religious groups. They really are oppressing the Mosquito Indians. They really are doing a variety of things that they're accused of doing. Are we, as Christians, then justified in fighting a war or paying for a proxy war because of these violations? You can only speak for yourself, but what do you think?
I would say yes in one case, that we understand ourselves as an empire seeking peace within the empire. And so if we take like full responsibility for considering ourselves a multinational empire of sorts, then the war, then we'd have to do more than just a war. It wouldn't be defensive, and so we have to do some previous steps, but I guess that ends up being no.
I guess
so. We wouldn't have gotten to the point of war had we already presupposed our imperial status.
Well, I can't really. I don't know the answer, but I would like to just put a slightly different viewpoint.
Sure.
Is that the, and I know Reagan's coming out as the Vatican, I can't defend Reagan and pick on Reagan, but if we look at the budget over the past several years, and I don't know the exact number, and we may be spending 20% more than we used to on, quote, defense, but a substantial part of our taxes are what we go towards defense. And it isn't just a Democratic administration, Republican administration, or Oliver North, Reagan, or whatever, but our Congress, or Democrat, Republican, Christian, or Jewish, wherever they are, and the people have more or less acquiesced to a certain level of defensive spending.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and a certain level of social spending. So that your taxes go for more than one thing, and the point I want to make is not Ronald Reagan who has started taxing the American people to spend money on defense. And
yes.
I think that's what I keep hearing, that Ronald Reagan is doing something, and I think
you're
that's
right.
Completely wrong.
That's no, I didn't. The only reason I'm bringing Ronald Reagan now is that he happens to be president right now.
Right, and you could substitute the president, and he could be whoever.
But the issue, if you're fighting, is it appropriate for us to be supporting wars of liberation, as we define it, if they're fighting for freedom and democracy?
I'm really intrigued by the argument of it as we are an empire, because in a sense we are. If we say we don't like that and we pull back to our borders, then I think we go back to the 1930s and isolationism. We just say, forget everybody else, we'll just take care of our own borders. Which doesn't make sense either within our world. We're multinational. Our economic system spreads across the whole globe, and we can't ignore that. But when you see the Soviet Union doing similar things like that, or other nations doing fighting wars of proxy, so we do just ignore those and just say, well, they're doing it. We don't have anything to do with that. Do we have work with diplomacy? Is that the only thing we can work with? Or how do we acknowledge our global situation?
Well, now, does what Luther's saying have about just war and his distinction between the two kingdoms, and does that help inform our thinking about that at all, or is it simply irrelevant in the modern age?
Yeah. the way it would help for me as regards Central America is that it, I think it leaves us a place to stand against society and opposing that. It calls the church to stand against the secular decision-making body.
Because?
Because we within the empire don't agree with that policy.
Other people, I mean, several people have been sharing their thoughts, but a number of you have been silent.
Oh, yes. I'd like to make a comment about number two, the two governments, spiritual and temporal. That relates to the Greek origins of separation of secular and religious. Mm-hmm. And in black African churches, they do not do that. This is why we have conflict with groups rallying under Bishop Tutu or anyone else, even though they don't want to be the leaders of such a revolution. They believe that social, political, religious, environmental, everything is combined into one. I think we get sidetracked with, okay, I'll follow the secular because it looks good, and yet it's against my religion, and there's this struggle. If it's against your total spirit-filled attitude to what the world is, you won't be involved in anybody else's fights, because all of our sense of being Christian is thou shalt not kill. And this is the problem I see it, is that we will fight proxy wars because, well, it's not on my soil, it's my economic interest, it's my government, right or wrong, and we start separating things out. It's part of myself that Nicaraguans are dying in a proxy war. And I can't live with that. And yet we seem to be very selective in which proxy wars we're going to fight. Under Somoza, in terrible repression, we kept him in power. We just ignored the National Guard killing, raping, and looting. Why weren't we in there fighting against Somoza? I have real problems with this sort of rationalization of proxy wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, liberation theology, at least in Nicaragua, as I understand it, there is a fusion of nationalism and Christian faith. And so the distinction secular, temporal, I mean, on one side and spiritual on the other may not even fit very well in Nicaragua, I don't know. So this may not be of any, this analytic distinction may not work. But of course Islam is another case, the fundamentalist revolution in Iran, where there's the fusion of the two. Luther thought the distinction was important because he felt that on the one hand you could have the state coercing or telling people what they had to believe, and on the other hand you could have the church essentially by making appeals to a higher authority overruling all of these concerns. Luther said at one point that a good Turk will make a better ruler than a bad Christian, or may make a better ruler, because it's not a matter of your religious beliefs, but how well you rule on the basis of justice and mercy.
I really appreciate Luther's two governments, because I think to fuse it, that gets you right back into the Crusades mentality, or much more easily moves you towards the Crusade mentality, that we have the rightness on our side, God is with us, and we are going to pursue our war to the very ends because God is with us. And we sense that. And I think we are always going back to that. I think that's part of our sinful nature. Luther talks about that much more clearly, that the verse simul justus et peccator, and that we're simultaneously sinner and saint. And if we go back to the two governments blending those two, we have a much more of the danger of going back and saying, we have God on our side and we're going to pursue our war because it's a just war, it's a right. Mm-hmm. That scares me much more than to separate the two and have to deal with the problems that are on in the separation. I think that's much more realistic than who we are as human beings.
Well, we each have to decide on our own here in the 20th century. Luther may or may not be helpful, but I hope that now as you go off to lunch or coffee or whatever, or hiking, that you might talk about some of these things and see whether they might inform you and your responsibility, everything from paying taxes to writing letters to your congressperson. And God willing, I hope we're not in a position that Lutherans were in at all 20 years ago, when Lutherans because they came out of a just war tradition, for some time were refused any conscientious objector status because of the way the laws were set up. You had to be opposed to all wars, was the argument. Lutherans eventually got it by arguing that they were opposed to all wars that could be conceivably fought in their lifetime. And the court said you didn't have to refight the Civil War. But for a long time, and the Lutheran Church was very slow in giving support to conscientious objectors within its ranks. But I think there is, in fact, if we go back to our tradition, there is authority both for cooperation but also for opposition. And we can't simply say, well, we're a Lutheran, we have to cooperate. We say that we're a Lutheran and a Christian, and we have the responsibility to decide and bear the consequences of that decision.